This is Marilyn Kleinberg-Niemark for Beyond the Pale. For years, child advocates in New York State have been pressing the legislature to pass laws that would make it easier for law enforcement authorities to go after child sexual abusers. To that end, they've sought to extend the statute of limitations and to provide a temporary window within which past cases can also be pursued. Time after time, proposed bills have failed in the face of heavy lobbying by Catholic and Jewish religious bodies. But a new legislative effort is afoot this spring, endorsed by Governor Andrew Cuomo. The immediate impetus appears to be the revelations of sexual abuse on college sports teams, specifically the cases of Jerry Sandusky at Penn State and Bernie Fine at Syracuse University. So this seems like a good time to catch up with what's been happening with efforts to unmask and bring to justice child sexual abusers within local Orthodox Jewish communities. To do so, we've asked the Jewish Week's Hella Winston and attorney Michael Lesher to talk with us. Hella Winston's been reporting for several years, primarily in the Jewish Week, about the shadow justice system that abets the covering up of allegations of child sexual abuse within Orthodox Jewish communities. She's currently a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Reporting at Brandeis University. Michael Lesher is a writer and an attorney who represents victims of child sexual abuse. He's a contributor to Tempest in the Temple, Jewish Communities and Child Sex Scandals. Welcome, Hella and Michael, to Beyond the Pale.
Hi, thank you.
Hella, let's start with you. When we last spoke, just over 2 years ago, you laid out for us the various roadblocks to identifying and prosecuting child sexual abusers in the ultra-Orthodox communities. Can you summarize what these roadblocks are and bring us up to date on where things stand now? Is there more support for speaking out?
First of all, in terms of roadblocks, this is something we've discussed a lot, which is that it's very difficult for people in these communities to come forward because there's a prohibition, a sort of a cultural taboo against informing to the authorities, and that's something that prevents and has prevented people from coming forward in the past. People who do often are subject to threats or intimidation or can be ostracized or not believed, actually. I mean, that's sort of the primary one. And if you go to the police, you risk a lot in this community. That said, I think there are more people coming forward. I think something has changed. There seems to be more grassroots support for people within these communities. There are some disparate but loosely connected advocacy groups or individuals who are attempting to advocate and are helping this process, but I would say we still have a long way to go.
And Michael, you represent several alleged victims of Avraham Mondrowitz, who's a psychotherapist who fled to Israel in the mid-80s amid allegations that he was abusing patients in his practice. His case is a particularly egregious example of how child sexual abuse cases in the Orthodox community have been mishandled by the Brooklyn DA's office. Can you sketch out the background of the case and bring us up to date on where things stand now?
Sure. Avraham Mondrowitz represents a particularly egregious case on several levels. One is just the sheer extent of the abuse of which he is accused. He was indicted on, I think, 14 counts, including first-degree sodomy and first-degree child abuse. That's actually a small fraction of what he's believed to have done. Police believed he may have abused as many as hundreds of kids, and the total was certainly in the scores based on police reports. He was probably abusing children for years, both in a school that he helped to administer and then in a private psychotherapy practice that he ran out of a basement office of his house. He had no credentials to do any of this. He's always been a master imposter. He just cut a huge swath through the community before anybody went to the police. What really makes the case alarming from our point of view, as we look back on it now and place it in today's context, is that district attorney's office, especially under the leadership of Charles Hines from the time he took office in 1990, was remarkably backward in how it pursued this case. Mondrowitz fled the country at the end of 1984 to avoid arrest, but his whereabouts were well known. He was in Israel, and Hines' predecessor had made efforts to have him extradited. Hines' office, however, from the time he took over, made no effort to have Mondrowitz return to the United States to stand trial. And in 1993, actually told the Justice Department to close the case as long as Mondrowitz remained in Israel. That's documented by a memorandum that the Justice Department generated, and I was ultimately able to obtain through a Freedom of Information Act request, showing that, in fact, Hines's office position was, as long as Mondrowitz remains in Israel, we don't want to pursue the case against him. If he leaves Israel, we would consider reopening at that time. again, understand, he was at that time a fugitive from justice, wanted on some of the most serious counts in the New York Penal Code, and there's no reason to believe that it would have been impossible either to extradite or deport him to see to it that he could stand trial in Brooklyn. The office just didn't want to. And the evident reason they didn't want to was that they had a Jewish advisory council representing the interests of the Orthodox community in Brooklyn, and that council, consistent with the attitudes of the leadership of the community, really did not want a case like this publicized. So this goes back to the mid-80s. In 2007, due to a good deal of public pressure, the district attorney did, in fact, reopen its request to have Avraham Mondrowitz extradited from Israel. And that request was made by the State Department and initially granted by the Israeli government. Mondrowitz went to the Israeli courts, and ultimately the Israeli Supreme Court, in a decision handed down in January 2010, quashed the order. So he's still living safe in Israel. What I'm trying to do is obtain under New York's Freedom of Information Law, which is closely modeled on the Federal Freedom of Information Act, the record of what happened vis-a-vis the district attorney's office during the period in which this case was subject to an attempted extradition. Supposedly the office was trying to bring him back. What were they really doing? Now, it may have been nothing, or their efforts may have been entirely exemplary. But the office has steadfastly refused to share one single page out of their file, going all the way back to 1993. They're taking the position that every bit of that file is completely exempt from public review. And in fact, when we argued this case at the Court of Appeals, the attorney from the district attorney's office actually said, this case will be entirely off limits to the public as long as Avraham Mondrowitz is alive. What they're saying is, and you have to try to understand this in the context of all the other sex abuse cases that have been arising recently within the Orthodox community, they're saying none of these cases should be seen by the public in any way, shape, or form as long as the perperpetrators are alive. That's a really extreme position, and it's quite a novel position, and it's one that they don't take with respect to other communities.
And that, of course, explains the importance of this case beyond that particular accused, Mondrowitz. You're listening to Beyond the Pale, and I'm talking with Hella Winston of the Jewish Week and attorney Michael Lesher. Hella, you've pointed out that not only has D.A. Hynes stonewalled in that case, but he's refused to release information about the identities of more than 90 child molesters from the ultra-Orthodox community whom his office claims to have arrested in the last, I guess, 2 years or so. Why this foot-dragging?
Well, it's a good question. The DA has given as an explanation for this the fact that releasing identities of alleged pedophiles or alleged sex abusers would somehow tend to identify a victim. Nobody that I've spoken to has been able to explain why that would be the case. And it seems as if the DA is hiding behind that to justify not sharing information about the people who've been arrested through this program. And one of the big questions is, not only do we not know who has been arrested, and these are arrests that have been made under a program that the DA founded in 2009 called Kol Tzedek. It's really a confidential hotline where members of the Orthodox community in Brooklyn can call and report abuse to the authorities. And that was a program that was developed in partnership with several social service organizations within that community, including OHEL and Met Council. These are the cases, the 90-plus cases that the DA has referred to in public statements, most recently in a radio broadcast on the Zev Brenner Show. These are all cases where he is refusing to even identify, just by name, who these people are, and we've been given some information without names attached as to what's happened to 14 of these cases, but then there are a whole host of other cases where the cases may have been dismissed or pled out, or we don't know what, honestly, because part of the problem here is if we don't have access to the names of these people, there's no way for members of the public to even request the records. It seems like there's special treatment being given to this one group. I don't know of other groups within the society that get this kind of treatment to get the names of their alleged perpetrators shielded from public view. And beyond that, there are perhaps dangerous pedophiles out there abusing children, possibly not just in the Orthodox community, but in the community at large, and we don't know who they are.
In the blog Failed Messiah, they've reported that there is an arrangement between the Brooklyn DA's office and religious groups like Agudat Israel for handling both child sexual abuse and domestic abuse cases within the Orthodox community. And they describe a protocol that they seem to follow. Are you familiar with that protocol?
This is a report that came out of the, if I remember right, the Agudat Convention. And it was reported by people who say, anonymous people who claim to have been there. Whether this actually binds the district attorney or not, whether he's agreed to it, I don't know. Hella will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he's actually spoken publicly about that and denied that there was any such deal with Agudat Israel.
Yeah.
What we do know, and I think this is very important, is that, as Hella said, the district attorney essentially formed a partnership with Ohel Children's Home in April of 2009 to control its procedures for taking and pursuing charges of child sex abuse within the Orthodox Jewish community. Now, apart from the fact that Ohel has its own troubled history, in which it's been repeatedly accused of participating in child abuse cover-ups over the years, I think it's fair to say that these new secrecy standards, the new refusal of a district attorney to share information on these prosecutions with the public, dates almost exactly to the time that program was launched. I think it's a pretty fair deduction to say that there is a connection between the role of Ohel Children's Home, which is a very important and influential institution in the Orthodox community, and on the one hand, and this new policy on the other. And part of the policy of secrecy is always a policy of deviating from the letter of the law. If you're doing everything by the book, you don't really care if the public has information about it. The reason you want the public to have information, the reason that the policy of the law is to have for the public to have information, is to make sure the law is being followed. Generally speaking, when government doesn't want that information out there, it's because the government has something to hide.
So speaking of the law, I mentioned when we began the segment the renewed legislative efforts in Albany to increase the rights of victims of child sexual abuse. New York apparently lags behind other states in providing adequate protections for these victims. What's the problem with New York's current laws?
One of the things that this bill is hoping to accomplish is to extend the statute of limitations. Right now, somebody has generally, and this is general because then there are specific differences depending on different circumstances, but in general, a victim has until 23, which is 5 years beyond the age of majority, to come forward and disclose abuse in a criminal matter. And I believe it's the same for civil matters, but again, there's some slight differences. This law would extend it to 28, but the really important and yet controversial aspect of this bill is opening up a window, and the window would be a one-year time frame during which anybody who has a civil claim, no matter when the abuse allegedly occurred, could come forward and file a lawsuit within that period. And that is obviously something one can understand that a lot of institutions and individuals would be opposed to, because suddenly, you know, it would open the door to all sorts of liability. However, one of the debates about all of this is whether there should really be a statute of limitations at all on these kinds of crimes, because the research seems to indicate that most people who have been sexually abused as children don't typically disclose the abuse until their 20s, 30s, sometimes even 40s. So even extending it to the age of, say, 28, I think a lot of people feel is not adequate, because this happens to be a crime that people have a hard time disclosing, and it takes them a long time to disclose. So that's part of the argument for extending it.
In New Jersey, for example, a statute was enacted not long ago, if I'm not mistaken, for civil suits, not for criminal ones, but for civil claims involving child sex abuse. You have a provision that allows you to use the discovery of the nature of the damage against yourself as the beginning of the running of the time. In other words, if you were, and this is still being worked out in the New Jersey courts, but the way it's come down so far is that if you were in therapy and realized in therapy that you had been sexually abused, or more precisely, you knew what had happened to you, but you now understand that it was really a cause of damage to you, that you can bring your action based upon that date rather than the date when the incident occurred. For looking from outside at these sorts of claims, that might sound a little bit strange, but the truth is it makes a lot of sense based on the way people really do come upon these claims, the way they pursue them. There are a lot of things that we have a right to expect people to act promptly on. If you've been robbed, if you've been physically assaulted most of the time, and we would expect that within a reasonable period of time from that date, you would know that you ought to pursue remedies against the person or persons who wronged you. But the research seems to show that in cases of child sexual abuse, that is not always a reasonable assumption at all. People tend to block it out. People don't fully recognize the effects of it. They may not even remember what was done to them until they begin to experience the effect many years later. Holding them to the same standard as people who have suffered other injuries really can work an injustice.
There's one thing I could add to this, which is that specifically in the Orthodox community, what we have seen till now, and it does seem to be changing, is that there have been older members of these communities, and for a multitude of reasons, either they've, let's say, moved away from Brooklyn, or you know, they just their lives are different, they're more secure, they're only able to come out at a much older age. And in some cases, people going public, even though they haven't been able to pursue any kind of legal remedies, at least speaking out has actually brought out younger victims. But particularly in these communities, you have a situation where it's very, very hard for people to go up against the powers that be and come out with this.
Yeah, along that line, I think it's worth remembering that there's more to consider here than just changing the statute of limitations. For example, there's already a law in New York on the books that requires prosecutors to share with a victim or a witness who may be subject to intimidation what steps they can take to protect him or her from efforts to keep him from going into court and testifying. This was enacted mostly with organized crime in mind. But the truth is, it really fits like a glove. Many of the situations that we see in the Orthodox community where people really are strongly dissuaded and sometimes even threatened to prevent them from going to the police or actually testifying in court, as far as I know, this is something the district attorney has never actually done. It's all already on the books. And activism could result in the district attorney and the police being more active in stepping forward, not only to encourage these people to come forward in the first place, but to protect them once they do.
The problem of a district attorney like Hines, who's elected by this very same constituency, at least in part, that we're talking about, going up against that constituency's strongly held views is not peculiar to New York. There have been articles about, for example, the community in Lakewood, New Jersey, which is also an ultra-Orthodox community. So you've suggested, Michael, that maybe this is something that shouldn't be local.
Well, it depends what's happening. But if you have credible evidence, for example, of discrimination against a class of victims, that's something I think that could be looked into by federal prosecutors who would be less bound to the same political constituency that perhaps is making that discrimination happen. There are ways of addressing that. I think you can also do it even without having outside federal scrutiny, though that, in fact, may be necessary in the end, just through mobilizing the community as a whole. As influential as the Orthodox Jews are in Brooklyn, they're by no means the only community. And people have to realize that the entire justice system is in many ways being compromised when this community is given preferential treatment in criminal cases. That's something that really affects everybody.
I've been talking with Hella Winston of The Jewish Week and attorney Michael Lesher. Thank you both for joining us today on Beyond the Pale.
Thank you.